This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. Ukrainian forces endured heavy artillery barrages on Sunday as they held off Russian attempts to capture the largest city, Kyiv, and still controls in the Luhansk region of the Donbas, according to Ukrainian officials. More from VOA's Marissa Melton.
The shelling was so intense it was not possible to assess casualties and damage, according to the governor of Luhansk. Dozens of buildings have been destroyed over the past few days. The Ukrainian government, meanwhile, urged the West to provide it with more long-range weapons to turn the tide in the war, which is now in its fourth month. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky visited Ukrainian troops on the front lines in northeastern Kharkiv region on Sunday. The trip marked his first official appearance outside Kyiv region since Russian President Vladimir Putin launched the invasion of Ukraine on February 24th. Ukrainian troops pushed Russian forces back from around Kharkiv earlier this month, but the city has come under renewed artillery fire this week. Marissa Melton, VOA News.
U.S. President Joe Biden grieved with the shattered community of Uvalde on Sunday. He mourned privately for 3 hours with anguished families left behind when a gunman killed 19 schoolchildren and two teachers. The president was met with chants of "do something" as he departed a church service and responded, "We will." Biden and his wife Jill visited a memorial to those who were slain at Robb Elementary School and attended Mass at Catholic Church. Biden met privately with first responders before flying back to his home in the U.S. state of Delaware. And again, President Biden grieved with those shattered community members on Sunday in Uvalde, that's in Texas. He mourned privately for 3 hours with the families left behind when the gunman killed the 19 schoolchildren and two teachers. This is VOA News. A leftist former rebel and populist businessmen have taken the top two spots among the six candidates in Colombia's presidential election, and they're heading to a runoff showdown in June, delivering a blow to the country's political class. Electoral officials say that the leftist Senator Gustavo Petro led Sunday's results with just over 40% of the vote, while independent real estate tycoon Rodolfo Hernandez finished second with more than 28%. The vote was held amid the polarized environment and growing discontent over increasing inequality and inflation. Petro has promised to make significant adjustments to the economy and to change how Colombia fights drug cartels. Hernandez has promised to clean up corruption in the South American nation. The first hurricane of the season has formed off Mexico's southern Pacific coast, and it's rapidly growing stronger ahead of an expected strike along a stretch of tourist beaches and fishing towns as a major storm. The U.S. National Hurricane Center says that Hurricane Agatha could hit as a Category 3 hurricane Monday afternoon or evening in the area near in the southern state. The region includes the laid-back tourist resorts. And in early evening Sunday, Agatha had maximum sustained winds of 110 miles per hour. That is just 1 mile per hour below the threshold for a Category 3. It was centered about 160 miles southwest of Puerto Angel and heading to northeast at 5 miles per hour. Hundreds of flight cancellations worldwide occurred by mid-afternoon Sunday, adding to the mounting number of scrub flights during the busy Memorial Day holiday weekend. About 1,460 flights have been canceled as of 7 p.m. Sunday, according to a flight tracking website, FlightAware. That follows more than 2,300 cancellations Friday, another 1,500 on Saturday. Nearly 450 of Sunday's cancellations involved aircraft scheduled to fly to or from U.S. cities. Delta Airlines canceled the most flights among major airlines. Delta and Saturday's cancellations were because of bad weather and air traffic control actions, according to Delta. And recapping our top story, Ukrainian forces endured heavy artillery barrages on Sunday as they held off Russian attempts to capture the largest city, Kyiv, and still controls in the region of the Donbas area, according to Ukrainian officials. There is more at voanews.com. Again, voanews.com. Via remotes, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Thank you. Today is Monday, May 30th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinerofo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, Russian President Vladimir Putin demands an end to European sanctions as his forces push into eastern Ukraine.
In an 80-minute telephone call with leaders of France and Germany, the Kremlin says Putin affirmed Moscow's openness to resuming peace talks, but warned against the continued transfers of Western weapons to Ukraine.
President Joe Biden comforts families in Uvalde, Texas, as fury mounts over the response of law enforcement to last week's shooting.
A teacher from Robb Elementary School grieves over her lost students. Their names posted at this memorial, all victims of the shooting by a teenage gunman.
And Pope Francis announces the elevation of 21 priests to the rank of cardinals. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. As Russian forces continue to move on small cities in eastern Ukraine, President Vladimir Putin is demanding European nations halt sanctions on his country and weapons shipments to Ukraine. Associated Press correspondent Ben Thomas reports.
In 80-minute telephone calls with leaders of France and Germany, the Kremlin says Putin affirmed Moscow's openness to resuming peace talks, but warned against the continued transfers of Western weapons to Ukraine, and also blamed Western sanctions for the disruption to global food supplies created by the war. Meantime, Russia's defense ministry released footage of Russian fighters and claimed its forces had captured another small city in the Donbas, the second to fall this week. After failing to occupy Ukraine's capital, Russia has set out to seize the last parts of the eastern region not controlled by Kremlin-backed separatists. I'm Ben Thomas.
To analyze Russia's recent offensives and how sustainable international aid to the country may be, Flashpoint's Ukraine host Steve Miller speaks with Stephen Horrell. He's a non-resident senior fellow with the Transatlantic Defense and Security Program at the Center for European Policy Analysis.
First thing I would stress is that in addition to Russia's operational level objectives and their weight of effort in eastern Ukraine and the Donbas, they are still focused on the rest of the south. So out to the key port cities of Mykolaiv and Odessa from Kherson. They have a little less weight of effort there, but have also continued missile strikes in the region. So it's important to note it's not just the east, but also the south. So having secured the land bridge from the territories held by the Russian-led separatists in the Donbas in eastern Ukraine to Crimea with the fall of Mariupol, I think those continued operations in the east are really designed to then expand the territorial holdings there to get to some end state.
We look back to earlier this week with Jens Stoltenberg speaking at the World Economic Forum. He mentioned that Vladimir Putin, the Russian president, had failed to achieve his initial objectives in Ukraine. And you just mentioned that perhaps Russia is downgrading its overall objective. So what do you see as perhaps a realistic objective for the Russian military operations in Ukraine?
I definitely agree with the Secretary General. Those initial strategic objectives were clear. You know, to completely take over Ukraine, but also that national identity question of Ukraine as a nation state rather than just little Russians and other Russian speakers. Secretary General Stoltenberg probably talked as well. You know, Putin quite clearly said a strategic objective was to redraw the global security architecture. I think that's happening, but not necessarily in the way he envisioned out there. So with those two objectives, you know, clearly will not be met, I think. Even the greatest Russian success in the current offensive in eastern Ukraine and the Donbas would not get to taking over the entire Ukraine territorially, but more importantly to him now, the decapitation of Zelensky administration. It's very, very hard to see a path from the current situation to that. So now let's go back to during the force buildup, when there was a lot of debate about will this or will this not be a full-scale invasion. You know, remember that there's a lot of talk about limited objectives or a limited invasion, and that all centered a lot around the expansion of the territories held by the Russian-led separatists in Donbas. Frequently, that was talked about to the administrative borders of the Donetsk and Luhansk oblasts. But again, that connection across the coast of the Sea of Azov, the land bridge to the Crimean Peninsula, and there was more musing then, but again, about Odessa.
That's Stephen Horrell, a non-resident senior fellow with the Transatlantic Defense and Security Program at the Center for European Policy Analysis, he spoke with Flashpoint Ukraine's Steve Miller. The African Development Bank, AFDB, is predicting slow economic growth and rising inflation in Africa because of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. At its annual meeting in Ghana, the FDB said African economies will grow by about 4% this year, compared to almost 7% last year. The bank said consumer prices will jump by 13.5% as the invasion continues to impact fuel and food costs. Kent Mensah reports from the Ghanaian capital, Accra.
According to the latest African Economic Outlook report by the African Development Bank, Russia's invasion of Ukraine and lingering effects of the COVID-19 pandemic pose huge challenges to the continent. The bank's president, Akinwumi Adesina, said at the launch of the report that it will take a great deal of effort for Africa to fully recover.
The recovery for Africa will be very costly. Africa will need at least $432 billion to address the effects of COVID-19 on its economies and on the lives of its people, resources that it does not have.
An economist at the University of Ghana, Edu Owususu Akodie, told VOA that African economies could recover quickly from the impact of the Russia-Ukraine war by trading among themselves and investing more in agriculture. The war cut off wheat exports from Ukraine, pushing food prices higher across Africa.
For Africa to get out of this mess, they have to look into local production. Our economy must be inward-looking at this point in time. There are some inputs that are in short supply. A typical example is fertilizer. And I think that African economies must be able to set up fertilizer plants to produce their own fertilizer. Wheat supply is also in shortage. Therefore, there must be an attempt to grow their own wheat.
Sarkozy lauded the African Development Bank for recently approving $1.5 billion to avert a food crisis on the continent by providing seed and other supplies to 20 million farmers.
The last thing we want to see in Africa is food crisis. And therefore, this amount of money, if available, should be invested in agriculture inputs, encourage food production, build storage facilities to store the food so that they can be available in lean season, and then build good roads. There's every need for us to start working towards ensuring food security now.
As the war in Ukraine and coronavirus pandemic continue to bite, pushing millions of Africans into extreme poverty, locals are hoping initiatives by the African Development Bank and their government will spark an economic rebound. Kent Mensah for VOA News, Accra, Ghana.
President Joe Biden on Sunday sought to comfort families in the Texan town of Uvalde following the nation's deadliest school shooting in a decade during his visit to the community. This as federal officials announced they would review law enforcement's slow response. Fury has mounted over the decision by the police to allow the shooter to remain in the classroom for nearly an hour while officers waited in the hallway and children inside the room made panicked 911 calls for help. Michael Sullivan reports that an outpouring of support from neighbors, churches and nonprofit organizations is helping them deal with the trauma.
A teacher from Robb Elementary School grieves over her lost students. Their names posted at this memorial, all victims of the shooting by a teenage gunman. Both friends and strangers console her, including the pastor of a church whose members also suffered losses. He says their faith and neighbors are helping them through this. This man lost a grandchild in the senseless shooting. Again, friends and strangers offer support, including a pastor from San Antonio. There are messages of encouragement and food served by a charity called World Central Kitchen, which visits sites of community disasters. And comfort dogs have been brought from other states for grieving residents by Lutheran Church Charities, and therapy dogs from another charity called Crisis Response Canine. The dogs will visit the injured in hospital and help wherever they're needed. This instructor from the Defense Language Institute at Lackland Air Force Base helps foreign military personnel improve their English. His international students asked him to come here, all sharing the grief and supporting those who have lost loved ones. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Uvalde, Texas.
An April mob attack in northern Ethiopia that left at least 30 Muslims dead and 100 injured has fueled revenge attacks on Christians. Witnesses and community leaders spoke with VOA about what they believe led to the violence. For VOA, Harry Wilkins' report from Gonda, Ethiopia.
The UN says it's deeply concerned over what it calls interreligious clashes in this and other parts of Ethiopia. The country is locked in a vicious civil war, and analysts warn religious violence could add to its list of problems. The incident sparked retaliatory violence and protests against the country, including in the capital, Addis Ababa, where there was damage to buildings downtown. Gonda authorities have kept a close eye on independent reporting, while Ethio Telecom has restricted internet access throughout the city. But VOA was able to speak to witnesses. Other witnesses said the violence was premeditated, deliberately targeting Muslims over the course of several days. The UN Commissioner for Human Rights has called on authorities to investigate what happened. Police say they have launched an inquiry. But a Christian leader in Gonda criticised the UN and said the violence is an isolated incident and that relations between Christians and Muslims in the city are good. The violence, he said, is fuelled by some with a political agenda, including rebel groups. A Muslim leader, however, says the violence has been brewing for years. A representative of the Ethiopian Orthodox Church in Gonda said there may be rogue preachers who engage in this kind of rhetoric, but they are not representative of the institution. One analyst says the Gonda conflict may be linked to both regional and religious identity. The Amhara region, where Gonda is situated, has seen a recent surge in ethnic nationalism. As investigations continue, the atmosphere in Gonda remains tense. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Gonda, Ethiopia.
In Nigeria, police in Rivers State have launched a probe into the circumstances that led to the death of at least 31 people in a stampede during a church charity program. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
The stampede occurred early Saturday at a local polo club in Port Harcourt, Rivers State, according to a spokesperson for the state police, Grace Woyengikuro Iringokoko. It was the venue for an annual church Shop for Free charity event organized by state-based King's Assembly Pentecostal Church to provide food and gift donations to underprivileged people. Officials say hours before the event began, large crowds tried to forcefully gain entry into the venue. A locked gate was broken open and people were trampled as they tried to get inside, according to Iringokoko. Most of the dead were children. Eyewitnesses say a pregnant woman was also among those killed. Chigozie Ibe was in the area Saturday.
They really planned the thing, but they made a mistake, I believe. They didn't involve the police. They didn't involve the security agency to control the crowd. So the crowd was too much.
Many of the injured have been hospitalized, but some local residents fear there may be more casualties. Saturday's charity program was supposed to be the fourth edition by the church since the event started years ago. For now, the church has suspended the program while police are investigating how the stampede occurred. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
In other news, Pope Francis has announced he will elevate 21 churchmen to the rank of cardinal in a ceremony at the Vatican in late August. Among those tapped by the pontiff to receive the prestigious red hat will be two prelates from India and one each based in Mongolia, Ghana, Nigeria, Singapore, East Timor, Paraguay, and Brazil, in keeping with Francis' determination to have church leaders reflect the global face of the Catholic Church. Francis read out his choices at the end of his traditional Sunday greetings to the public in St. Peter's Square. The majority of the new cardinals will be younger than 80 and thus eligible to vote for the next pontiff in secret papal conclave. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Search for VOA Africa. You are listening to VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Afo in Washington. The struggle for justice isn't over for the victims of Beirut's 2020 port explosion. Protests by families and friends of those who lost loved ones in the last blast, recorded as one of the largest non-nuclear explosions in history, continue, as do those by families whose relatives have been arrested while awaiting trial. Observers decried a lack of accountability by the government to deal with the national disaster, even as two Lebanese lawmakers charged in connection with the catastrophe won re-election to parliament. For VOA, Dale Gavlak reports from Amman.
Improperly stored ammonium nitrate at the Beirut port exploded on August 4, 2020, killing more than 215 people and wounding some 7,000, while leaving swaths of the Lebanese capital in ruins. Many Lebanese blamed the explosion on security and political officials who failed to enforce safety regulations. But now, nearly 2 years later, no one has been held accountable. On Friday, families of those arrested in the explosion case staged a sit-in in front of the Justice Ministry, demanding an immediate fair trial to allow them to prove their innocence, according to Lebanon's national news agency. Meanwhile, families and friends of victims continued their protests to demand justice, but many accused political power brokers of actively sabotaging the probe, blocking the judge appointed to investigate from doing his job and calling for an international investigation. Two Lebanese lawmakers with the Hezbollah-backed Shiite Amal movement, Ali Hassan Khalil and Ghazi Ziyatar, have sought to disrupt Judge Tariq Bitar from carrying out his investigation, which is now suspended. Both are charged in connection with the explosion, and yet they were both re-elected recently to parliament. Lama Fakeh directs Human Rights Watch in Beirut. She recently told the Carnegie Middle East Center there that the case cannot resume until new judicial appointments are made under a new prime minister and cabinet.
There is concern that this is, of course, going to take quite a long time. Historically, the formation of government hasn't even more than a year. There are very real obstacles to achieving justice for the victims of the blast domestically. And this is why we and others, including victims' families, have been calling for an international fact-finding mission to conduct an inquiry into the events surrounding the blast.
Kim Ghattas, a non-resident senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, says she hopes Lebanon's new parliament will tackle the serious crises engulfing Lebanon, including responsibility for the port explosion.
Accountability is really crucial to everything, whether it is accountability for what happened at the port, who was responsible at the various levels, whether it comes to accountability for who brought the country to its knees economically. That is really something that should be at the heart of the work of the members of parliament.
Observers blame Lebanese officials for constantly recusing judges investigating the explosion and stopping procedures when summoned for questioning, thus impeding the course of justice. Dale Gavlak for VOA News, Amman.
With the imminent return of power and influence of the Marcos family to the presidential palace in the Philippines, a former chair of the Presidential Commission on Good Government is worried about potential changes in the role of the body. Andres Batistusa is urging the commission to be more proactive in searching for ill-gotten wealth and billion-dollar assets, including a missing painting by a renowned Spanish artist. From Manila, Stanley Bonafé Gujete has the story.
Recently, the painting by Pablo Picasso resurfaced online after being spotted inside the house of former dictator Ferdinand Marcos' wife, Imelda. Andres Bautista is the former head of the Presidential Commission on Good Government, or PCGG. He wants current officials to be proactive in returning the expensive work of art to the Filipino people.
Ako mismo, nakita ko yung painting na yan eh. Kasi nung binisita namin si dating unang ginang Imelda Marcos.
Bautista says he himself saw the alleged missing painting by Picasso inside the residence of former First Lady Imelda Marcos. Bautista detailed that he and Commissioner Richard Amurao went to the home of Imelda Marcos at the Pacific Plaza condominium in Manila. There, they saw the work of art called The Reclining Woman 6, worth about $156 million in the 1970s. But Attorney Vic Rodriguez, the spokesperson of President-elect Bongbong Marcos, did not provide a specific answer and told Bautista, who lives in the United States, to come home and file the allegations in person.
The allegation is coming from, I believe, the former chair of the COMELEC. You know, it's very easy to be agitating people, making allegation, making accusation, when you are thousands of miles away from your motherland. I invite you, Chairman Andy Bautista, to come home if you're confident enough, make your allegations here in person.
Bautista said in 2014, the PCGG applied the writ of attachment that sent sheriffs to different residences and offices of Marcos' family. However, despite the effort, the group did not find the original Picasso painting. But many are nervous because they say the new president could defunct the commission. For VOA News, I am Stanley Buenafegahete in Manila, Philippines.
Go beyond the daily headlines with VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. Each weekday at 2105 UTC, join me, Steve Miller, as I put the latest developments into a global context with interviews and analysis. Listen online at voanews.com/flashpoint or in your favorite podcast player.
And to all our VOA listeners, please note we have moved our programs to a new website, voaafrica.com, from voanews.com. There you will find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. Find us on voaafrica.com, and thanks for listening. This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voaafrica.com. Until next time, I am Chinedu Afo in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In advance of the May meeting of the World Health Assembly, the WHA, which is the decision-making body of the World Health Organization, the WHO, Secretary of State Antony Blinken strongly advocated for Taiwan to be allowed to participate as an observer and lend its expertise to the solution-seeking discussions. For most of the past 50 years, Taiwan participated robustly in certain UN specialized agencies where statehood is not a requirement. Recently, however, its engagement in these fora has been constrained. In a written statement, Secretary Blinken noted that today's unprecedented health threats demand close international cooperation. The annual meeting of the World Health Assembly is an opportunity, he said, to drive cooperation towards ending the acute phase of the COVID-19 pandemic and advancing global health and global health security. Inviting Taiwan to attend the WHA as an observer would exemplify the WHO's commitment to an inclusive approach to international health cooperation and health for all. At a press briefing, State Department spokesperson Ned Price pointed out that Taiwan's expertise and approaches in the realm of global health and beyond that realm as well can benefit the world. He noted that the WHO broke years of precedent at the 70th World Health Assembly in 2017 when it failed to invite a Taiwanese delegation to attend as an observer, a failure that has been maintained every year since then. As we continue to battle a pandemic, as we continue to confront other public health threats, Taiwan's isolation from the world's preeminent global health forum itself represents a serious health concern, spokesperson Price said. We believe that Taiwan's significant public health expertise, its technical and technological capabilities, its democratic governance, its resilience in the face of COVID-19, and its robust economy offer considerable resources to inform the WHA's deliberations, and we believe there is no reasonable justification to exclude its participation. Secretary Blinken declared that the United States will continue to support Taiwan's membership in international organizations where statehood is not a requirement and encourage Taiwan's meaningful participation in organizations where its membership is not possible, in line with our One China policy, which is guided by the Taiwan Relations Act, the three U.S.-China joint communiques, and the six assurances.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.